You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at ConsiderThis.us, and we're also on the KZYX website, where you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448, or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My returning guest is linguist Daniel Everett. He's Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bentley University in Waltham, Massachusetts, and the author of many books, including Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, and Language, the Cultural Tool. And his life and work is also the subject of a documentary film, The Grammar of Happiness. I interviewed him earlier this year for his book, Dark Matter of the Mind, The Culturally Articulated Unconscious. And we have him back for his new book, How Language Began, The Story of Humanity's Greatest Invention. He argues that we are not born with an instinct for language and that the near 7,000 languages that exist today are the product of perhaps a million years of evolution. Dan Everett, welcome back to Consider This.
Thank you very much for having me back again.
It's my pleasure. So in this book, you're presenting a story of the evolution of language, really even the invention of language, that counters a long-standing view held by, I think, arguably one of the most well-known linguists, Noam Chomsky. So I'd like you to start by asking you to kind of set the stage, situate your theory against that kind of theory, and give us at least kind of a rough outline of some of the main differences between his view and your view.
Sure. So the human line, all of us who belong to species under the genus Homo, so we are the wise species. We're Homo sapiens. Homo means man. Prior to us was Homo neanderthalensis, Neanderthals. And prior to Neanderthals, there's quite a bit of discussion about how many groups to make, but the one that everyone agrees about is Homo erectus, upright man, the first humans. So most who have looked at these issues over the years agree that Homo sapiens were the originators of language, and that not many years ago, in fact 100,000 years ago, which by evolutionary times and by the length of the time of our species on the planet, it's pretty much yesterday. And Chomsky's view is that we see Homo sapiens with art, clear forms of art, and a number of accomplishments, and those could have only be explained through language, and therefore that language was it was a genetic mutation that allowed us to have grammars and that made language possible for Homo sapiens, but no other creatures ever, not any other Homo of the genus Homo or any other species has had anything like human language because they lack the gene for this kind of grammar, which he calls a recursive grammar. My view is that, in fact, when we look at the archaeological record, we find tremendously impressive accomplishments, not only in Neanderthals, but even much earlier, going back as far as 1.9 million years ago to Homo erectus, and that we see accomplishments of Homo erectus, one we could talk a bit in a bit more detail about, especially their sailing to different islands, that indicates that they must have had language or an advanced communication system. So the next thing is, what is language? Chomsky puts the most of the burden of the definition of language on a particular kind of grammar. I do not. I place the burden for what is a language on the possession of symbols, going back to the philosopher, American philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce. And so that really is the striking contrast. Did language start 50 to 100,000 years ago? That's Chomsky's view. Or did it start over a million years ago? And that's my proposal on how language began.
One other thing I just want to point out about it that you make a strong point about in the book is that you think of really as conversation as being the apex of language. That's what language is really about. It's about conversation. It's about interaction. It's about culture and relationships with other people.
That's right. symbols, what I consider to be so important, emerge from conversations and culture. You can't have symbols without culture. And conversation, you know, as I argued in my previous book, Language, the Cultural Tool, the purpose of human language is to establish human communities. We are a social creature, and we need language to help us build communities. So conversation and the stories that are part of conversation, they don't exist apart from conversation. Stories are what we tell one another in conversations. Conversations are the fundamental building blocks and accomplishments of human language.
So let's start to get into this evolutionary account, because that's really what it is. It's you speak of it both as an evolutionary account of language and as an invention. As an evolutionary account, we probably all have a basic understanding that if it's going to be that, it has to have conferred some kind of survival advantage to us. So could you start talking about what that advantage was, and take it all the way back to Homo erectus, and start to show us how their basic language, their use of symbols, some of the evidence for that, and how it developed over time.
Sure. So Homo erectus was preceded by Australopithecus, a small little 3.5-foot to 4-foot tall creature that was prior to humans appearing, was the smartest creature on the planet. It had a brain not that much different in size from a chimpanzee brain, but it seems to have been organized differently, and their accomplishments are more important, or more sophisticated. So to bring in Charles Sanders Peirce, he basically lays out three phases, I'm simplifying a bit, but three phases of the development of to get to symbols. The first are what he calls indexes. All animals that live can interpret indexes. In fact, without being able to interpret them, they couldn't survive. So what is an index? An index is something that is physically connected to something else. So if smell is connected to what causes the smell, smoke is connected to fire, footprints are connected to the feet that made them, there's a physical causation that takes place here. So you know, you see people tracking in the Western movies, or just animals that hunt, lions that hunt, or any other kind of creature, bees that try to find pollen, or honey, they are, to make honey, they are following indexes. One physical thing that is causally connected to another physical thing. It's the evidence for the other physical thing. After that comes icons. Icons are things that actually look like other things. So the Mona Lisa is an icon. David by Michelangelo is an icon. A picture of me is an icon. These are things that aren't the thing they represent, but look like the thing they represent. So fascinatingly, the oldest one of these we find in the archaeological record is what is called the Makapansgat pebble from a cave in Makapansgat, South Africa, and it's currently on display, I hear, at the British Museum in London. It's a 2-inch by 3-inch stone, and on it, it has what looks like the original smiley face that you see on T-shirts. It's, you know, two holes and then underneath, or two indentations, and then underneath another indentation that looks like a smile. Now, we know that Australopithecus didn't make these, or we certainly don't think they made them, but we do know that they recognized this. And the reason we know that, so this is, we're talking 3 million years ago now, we know this because the pebble was found in a cave that doesn't match it in terms of mineral content. It had to be carried there, so it's called a manuport. It's been carried there from miles away by Australopithecus. And the most logical, the easiest explanation for why it was carried there is because it looks like a human face. So we find the first evidence for an icon 3 million years ago. Peirce would have predicted this, that all animals have indexes, that only a few have icons. He never talked about evolution, but in terms of level of complexity, this is what he would have predicted. And the next are symbols. So what are symbols? If icons look like the thing they represent and indexes are physically caused by the things they represent, then symbols are conventional. They are cultural agreements. So why do we call in English a canine dog? because the word D-O-G is a symbol for the canine that we've all agreed upon. But Portuguese speakers call it cachorro for the same animal, so they've reached a different agreement on what to call this animal. So symbols are the ultimate accomplishment in terms of encoding representations of things around us, because they require culture to come about. And we see symbols after a while with Homo erectus, and we know that symbols can be, so for example, we find this several hundred thousand year old quartz axe buried with someone called Excalibur. And it is felt by most archaeologists who've looked at it that it is buried with someone as part of a burial rite. And so that's good evidence for a symbol. We have a 250, actually what got me thinking about this was touring the Israel Museum in Jerusalem and seeing what was labeled as the oldest piece of art ever discovered, and it was listed as 250,000 years old, and I thought they must have added an extra zero until I began looking at it. It's a Venus shape called the Venus of Barakat Ram, that was used by Homo erectus living in modern-day Israel. So we find strong evidence for symbols among Homo erectus, but more importantly, we find evidence that they had to communicate at a sophisticated level. And there are several sources of evidence for that. The tools that they used began to improve over time. Australopithecus and even some chimpanzees used stone tools. But erectus used them and improved upon them, carried them with them, and treated them differently than any other creature had treated them. And by the way, when erectus appeared, we had gone from the Australopithecus and chimpanzee brain of about 450 cc's to a brain now of about 950 cc's, which is roughly within the range of modern human females. Modern human males have a range of more like 1250 cc's for brain. Neanderthals had brains of more like 1,450 cc's, and sperm whales have brains of about 9,000 cc's. So we know that brain size can't be all there is to intelligence, so the sperm whale would be the most intelligent creature on the planet. It has to do with organization. But what we find is that erectus did have a brain that was very sophisticated in its organization and much larger, double the size of anything that had existed before it. And that's when we start to see these improvements in tools. We see evidence of upright posture on a regular basis, persistence hunting, running after creatures, and tracking the creatures. And that's very sophisticated, to be able to track them and not simply follow smell, but to be able to predict where they're going to be and look for them in places they're more likely to be found. And there's evidence for that. So we see tools. Another thing we see in Homo erectus, in addition to their traveling the entire known world, we find them, they originated about 1.9 million years ago, and by 1.8 million years ago, they're already in Beijing from East Africa. So they've walked in, they're in Europe, they're in the Middle East, they're in other parts of Asia, so they're walking around the world within a very short time. I should also point out that, interesting to me, Homo sapiens, us, we've been on the planet for 200,000 years, according to most researchers, maybe 500,000 according to some others. That's sort of the outlier figure, 500,000 years. But Homo erectus lived on Earth for almost 2 million years. They lived 4 to 10 times longer than our species has lived. So in that sense, they've been more successful so far in the record than we've been. It remains to be seen whether we'll survive another 800,000 to 2,800,000 years. And they coexisted with us. Homo sapiens came on the scene at least 200,000 years ago. Homo neanderthalensis came on the scene about 450,000 to 500,000 years ago. And erectus, we know that erectus lived until about 143,000 years ago, so they overlapped with both of us, and maybe even as recently as 60,000 years ago. So a spectacular creature. So they had tools. They also organized settlements. So there's an excavation happening right now in Israel of a Homo erectus settlement that's about 750,000 years old that shows different spaces for processing of animals, processing of plants, a residential area, so that they actually had planning, urban planning, if you will, and organized their spaces in a non-haphazard way. And they were very consistent about this. And so it's a fascinating archaeological excavation that's taking place there, and it's been going on for years. So we have village planning or settlement planning. We have tools. We have wanderings around the world. But then, for me, most spectacularly, what we find is that Homo erectus sailed. So we find evidence of Homo erectus colonies in Wallacea, which is a string of islands in Indonesia. We find evidence of Homo erectus settlement on Crete, the island of Crete in the Mediterranean, and some evidence for Homo erectus populations living on the island of Socotra off of Yemen. Now, the interesting thing about these three, and there's evidence for more places, but the interesting thing about these three places is that we believe, the evidence supports very strongly that they were not connected to land 2 million years ago or 100 or 1 million years ago. The times that erectus populated them, they had to get across large bodies of water. So to take Flores, which is about as was a not that long a trip, it was only about 15 miles. The world's strongest ocean current flows around Flores. And so people who have built rafts and tried to replicate Homo erectus sailing to Flores have shown that it couldn't have just been an accident that they got there, because once they get close to the island, the current would have carried them out to the open sea. There's no way to get to the island just by floating there. They had to paddle very hard. And we also know that they had to have a population of between 20 to 40 to establish the viable communities that we see evidence for on Flores. Socotra would have been 150 miles from shore and could not have been seen from shore, so they had to have been sailing. And whether they were blown off course and wound up at Socotra or whether they were intentionally exploring, they had to have the cognitive capability to build craft that could take multiple individuals across open water, and the same thing for Crete. And these are some of the most interesting, and the evidence for these been coming in for a few years, but it's only in the last 5 or 6 years that archaeologists have been really willing to make the statement that, yep, they were sailors. They sailed to these places. And any group that can sail has to be able to correct one another, has to have some sort of plan, has to be able to lay out. So when we talk about Homo erectus tools, very often it's pointed out that their tools were not as sophisticated as Homo sapiens or Homo Neanderthal tools. But in fact, if we look at the construction of rafts that they would have had to have, and several archaeologists have constructed rafts with stone tools based on the materials that would have been available there at the time, and shown that to do what they did, they had to be far above what we had thought of them in the past cognitively. So the fascinating thing to me is you have Australopithecus, which is basically not that much smarter than a chimpanzee from what we can tell. And then the next creature you see is a human being. And they just they dominated the world. They were the first people to be the first everywhere. I mean, these days, if you travel, you're always going to see somebody else. But if you were Homo erectus in the first wave, you were the first person ever to see the places you saw.
So a couple of things strike me about a lot of that you said. One, it sounds to me like you've made a very strong case that Homo erectus were intelligent. They had a level of cognition and thinking which was complex, and we haven't maybe previously thought that of them. And you make the claim in the book that really, it seems like you're making the claim, and correct me if I'm wrong, that kind of complex thinking precedes language, and that language is a cultural invention kind of to support and work with it. So that's one thing, and maybe I think these two are related, so I apologize if I'm giving you too much. But then in the stuff from Peirce, it seems to me that the real critical move is from icons to symbols. And you have to, if you're going to give an evolutionary account, which I think you do, you got to account for how that happened, how that move from icons to symbols happen. So if you could talk about both those, I think they're related, but if they're not, apologize.
Yeah, they're definitely related. So biology comes in providing us with this incredible new brain that the world had never seen before. Not like modern human brains. There were several deficiencies. Erectus was not as smart as we are, but it was still smarter than any gorilla that has ever existed, and it was smarter than any other creature on the planet today other than us. So we already know that other animals have sophisticated communication systems. But this was a creature far smarter than any other creature that's ever walked the earth except for Neanderthals and sapiens. So what do I mean by an invention? I mean that once they reach the critical intellectual threshold to begin to build communities, communication at a very high level, more than simply indexes and icons, became crucial to them. They needed symbols to be able to plan. They needed symbols to be able to build boats. They needed symbols to do these things. So what is an invention? Well, one naive view is that an invention is something some person comes up with out of the blue. So Edison just invented the light bulb, and before Edison there was nothing like the light bulb, and after Edison we had the light bulb. But we know that that's actually simplifying the story too much. Edison was able to invent the light bulb as part of a culture that provided him with the need, with all the raw materials or most of the raw materials. It's the same thing whether it's a light bulb or a canoe. These come from cultures gradually over time, and then at some point one person gets the credit for it. I mean, interestingly enough, this is why you have double discoverers of certain things. So the calculus was invented at the same time by Leibniz and by Newton. And they discovered this later, but they both came up with the calculus. Why? Because society had reached a level and the cultural values were such that people were thinking about things and the mathematics was improving and getting better, and it took an individual or a group of people to see the difference that calculus could make and to come up with the... So most of what we call inventions are really series of baby steps, and somebody took the last step. So a symbol in that sense, for me, results from a lot of baby steps to get to that. So how would you come up with a symbol? In some of the languages of central Brazil, the Je of the Je family, G-E, Je, there is something called ritual wailing, where people aren't really crying, but if you're not familiar with the culture, it can sound like they're crying, except that it sounds also like music, and it's got a regular rhythm to it. So what has happened here is that they've taken a normal, non-symbolic sound that we make, an index, which is a just crying, and they've made it into a symbol. They have transformed it into something that is, by cultural agreement, represents the loss or the absence or the return of a particular member of the culture. So it's not just crying. It doesn't have the same meaning as crying. It's been transformed from an index to a symbol. If I am walking through the jungle, which I've done many times, I'm always afraid of snakes because I don't see them as well as my Pitaha and other indigenous people who are accompanying me, my colleagues there. So I'm always worried about snakes. And every time I see a tree root come out on the surface, partially covered by leaves, I jump back because I think that could be a snake. So the root is actually an index of the tree. I see a root, I know there must be a tree, or there had to have been a tree, or there wouldn't be a root there. But as I confuse it with a snake, it's possible for that index now to become a symbol of snakes for me. It begins to represent, and if more people will agree with me, you know, this is how hieroglyphic systems arose. And I'm not claiming that Erectus had written language. There's no evidence whatsoever of that. But just as symbols arise in written language from pictures that then become conventionalized, sounds and sound groups become conventionalized. And so we find conventional sounds in lots of animals. But it took a human brain to take those sounds and make them mean something a little bit more arbitrary, something that can be used in a wider variety of contexts. The other thing that makes language possible, which I perhaps should have emphasized more in the book, but I did talk about it, is the ability to talk about things that aren't present and things that happened in the past or might happen in the future. And so to plan, you have to be able to talk about things that will happen in the future. To learn from the past and to improve your tools, you have to be able to talk about things that happened in the past. So we have strong evidence that from the improvement of their tools and the growth in their technology and their planning to take voyages, that they thought and were able to communicate about the past, the present, and the future. And the symbols are not that big a step from icons when you have brains like that. So the next thing you need is grammar. And Chomsky is absolutely right about that. To have a language, you have to have a grammar. But if I'm right, symbols are the most important thing and grammar is secondary. And the evidence that I have that grammar is secondary is the wide variety of the language in the languages of the world. So we find languages that sound, if you were to translate them literally into English, I can give a couple of examples from English. You drink, you drive, you go to jail. So those are three separate utterances. They're very simple. I just take the symbol you and the symbol drink and the symbol drive and the symbol go, symbol jail, and I put them together and just repeat you go, you know, jail, and I have a simple language that has symbols in a linear order, just left to right, or as they come out of my mouth. I can also, over time, reorganize those in a slightly more complex way, and I can say, if you drink and you drive, then you will go to jail, in which I've said those three sentences, but now as one sentence, and I've used this putting one sentence inside another, so there's actually three separate sentences that have been placed into one sentence there, and that's recursion. But it's not essential to language. It's a very efficient way for organizing information, but even in English we can talk without it. And very often if you watch films of people who are not supposed to be native speakers, unfortunately they tend to make Native Americans and most Westerns talk without recursion. So they just utter these simple utterances. So what I'm claiming is that it was an invention that depended on biological evolution of our brains and our vocal apparatus. They weren't able to make all the same sounds we had. Interestingly, Erectus had the same, roughly the same vocal apparatus as a gorilla, a little bit better for our purposes, but not much. So how many sounds do you need to be able to make to have a language? All computers show us that you only need two sounds, because anything you can say, you can say to Siri on your iPhone, and she just translates it into zeros and ones. It's just a sequence of zeros and ones. So zero is one sound, one is another sound. You only need two sounds to say anything that needs to be said. And they could have made several sounds. And we know modern languages that only have 11 sounds. So anything, if they could have easily made 11 sounds, so there's no reason that they couldn't have had a spoken language. It would have been, it would have sounded very foreign to us. It would have sounded like gorillas talking. But they were the talking, and at the time they lived, they were the Planet of the Apes. Hmm.
So a couple of things really strike me about what you're saying. One, and I want to highlight it, it may be obvious to everybody, but the thing that symbols do that leads to language is it really it allows for representation. It allows for this cultural agreement that particular symbols are going to mean something. So there's a kind of a bit of, I guess, disconnect from what happens with indexes and icons, but that's really crucial for the development of a language. It's really crucial for the power of language, is that ability to make that cultural agreement that this is what this symbol is going to mean. And it just opens up a wide door for the possibility of language. So if you just make that connection a little bit clearer, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, you've summarized it very well, in fact. John Searle, philosopher at the University of California at Berkeley, argued that Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote the book The Social Contract, got it wrong, that the first social contract was language itself, because without language, you can't do anything else. We have to agree on what our language is. We have to agree also on what our grammar is as a society before we can say anything. So we can't simply have icons. I mean, I could do a lot with icons. The gorilla Coco, for example, has learned to manipulate a number of icons, colored shapes, to communicate quite a bit. And when we look, icons, again, just resembling what they represent. So if we look at the first hieroglyphics or the earliest forms of the Chinese writing system, we see that it was just icons. It was just writing things down and little images that represented things. But here's the thing. Even with icons, it takes cultural understanding to interpret them. So not everything that I think looks like something is going to look like something to you. It may not look like the same thing to you. So we have to agree that we even have to have some initial agreement about icons. And you can see this anytime you go to a museum and interpret a painting. Paintings require interpretation. Even realist paintings require interpretation. So what we see is not what we get. What we get is interpreting what we're seeing in terms of a broad cultural base. And symbols encode this for us and enable us to talk about arbitrary things. So the preposition to, he went to town, is quite important for English speech, but it's not an icon of anything, right? It doesn't resemble anything. It is an agreed-upon symbol, that sound, T-O, to represent a transition of some sort, a preposition in this case. So indexes can't do that for us. We still use indexes. If a baby cries, we know there's a problem. That's an index. We interpret those all the time. We still use icons. We draw smiley faces. Emojis are great examples of icons making a resurgence in written language. So emojis are icons, and they're very popular. So we didn't abandon icons and indexes. We simply enriched our communication system by adding symbols and grammar. And grammar takes, three different levels. I talk about them in the book as a G1 grammar, which is just a grammar that has symbols in a particular order. So like you drink, you drive, you go to jail. You put the subject first and the verb second. Or you can have a grammar that says, the man who I saw is here. So who I saw is a sentence that modifies the man, and it is part of the larger sentence, the man is here. So that's the second kind of grammar you can have, and that's where one thing is inside another. And then the third kind of grammar is the kind of grammar that Chomsky claims is basic to all human languages, which I deny, which is being able to do this over and over and over again without any upper limit. So the man who is tall, who you saw yesterday, who we disputed, who may get the job we were talking, and just go on and on and on, that would be a recursive grammar. And there are advantages to having each one of those kinds of grammars. And my claim is that all Erectus would have needed was a G1 grammar, and they were in business. They had language. And it wasn't a proto-language, it was a full-blown language, because I argue in the book that there are modern human languages that are G1 grammars.
I want to get into next talking about this notion of culture, because your theory relies a lot on it, but I need to take just a quick break. I acknowledge to people that if you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Dan Everett. He's author of How Language Began, The Story of Humanity's Greatest Invention. But I need to take make a quick interruption about kind of the cultural creation that we at the radio station are. We are a community organization, and I don't know if you know, Dan, but we recently had a significant fire damage up here and a real kind of an emergency, and it's going on in Southern California right now. And we got a lot of accolades for the kind of coverage and support that we provided for the community during that fire. For a lot of people in the county, the fire knocked out cell phone service. It knocked down internet service. It knocked down a lot of things. And for many people for a long period of time, this radio station was the only thing that provided them with information about what was going on. And it was an emergency situation, so they really needed to have that kind of information. And in order to do that, which is a big part of our charter, is to serve the community in that way, as well as provide this kind of programming for people on a local level. And I think it really only happens at a local level. And we are primarily locally supported. So we're asking our members and our listeners to step up at this time at the end of the year and support us financially. That's our members' role, and we hope that it's our listeners' role who may not be a member, is to provide the financial support to keep this radio station going and keep this kind of programming going, keep our ability to deliver NPR news and all of the great music programming that we have. So this is not an official pledge drive, but we're trying at each program to remind our listeners and invite you to make an end-of-the-year donation. You can do that either at the station's website or by calling the radio station during regular business hours at 895-2324 and make a donation here at the end of the year, a tax-deductible donation in any amount that works for you. So sorry for that interruption, Dan, but I'd like you to get into talking about what is this thing called culture. If you could, there's so much more in the book that we're just not going to be able to talk about, and I do want to open the phone lines for people to give us a call, but I think this piece, at least, of culture needs to be brought in here, and as a part of that, maybe from the previous book, this idea of dark matter.
Right. So let me just say, based on your announcement there, that my wife and I had taken a vacation in Mendocino during the fires. We didn't know the fires would be there, and we drove up through Santa Rosa the day after the terrible fires, and I'm from California originally, in Southern California, and I remember as a teenager and a young man evacuating from fires before, so I feel it entirely, and we were listening to radio to know whether we could even proceed in our vacation and the things that we wanted to do. Culture, to me, as I break it down and I develop a theory of culture and dark matter of the mind, and I assume and use that theory in How Language Began, is a set of knowledge structures and a set of values, and they're ranked in order of importance. So, you know, for example, do not tell a lie for most of us is an important value, but it's less important than save a life. So if you want to save a life by telling a lie, most of us would think that was okay. And then social roles. So we all have different social roles, and we play different roles during the day. Right now, I'm the interviewee, and you're the interviewer. If we met in different circumstances, it could be entirely different kinds of roles, would-be kinds of roles. So culture develops from those basic building blocks. And so the claim that Erectus had culture is the claim that they had values, they had knowledge structures, and they had social roles. You could say that some other creatures besides humans fit that definition of culture, and I actually don't have any problem with that. I'm not trying to say that there are things that only humans are capable of. That is a very different perspective that I have. I think that other creatures don't have language because they don't have the brain power to do what we do. But if somebody could show me that they did, that's fine. I'm happy to accept that. And if you could show me clear evidence that other creatures have culture, and I think there is some evidence, I'm happy with that too. So I'm not trying to stake out a claim for the uniqueness of our species, except in degree of accomplishment. We've done things that no other species has done, and we've done it because of our brains, our upright posture, a lot of evolutionary good luck, and a few other things that make us who we are. So culture to me is, so one value is to communicate. And communicate what? Communicate things that we know about, things that we want to do. So knowledge structures will include all the plants around us, maybe, which ones are poisonous, which ones are okay to eat, the animals that are okay to eat, the animals that run faster than other animals, maybe about how to throw a rock. So there are all these kinds of knowledge structures that Homo erectus shows evidence of having had, especially in their sailing and village construction and tool development. And then social roles, you know, those, there are some societies in which the social roles are fairly homogeneous, so that there's no leader, but everybody has different things that they do from time to time in the village, whether it's male duties versus female duties, child duties, or best hunter duties versus best fisher duties. People begin to develop social roles, and the evidence that they organize their settlements in terms of animal production, plant production, and living shows us that they had some concept of different roles and different knowledge structures. So from this, we get the ability to agree upon what things mean. So we have a symbol, and that becomes part of our, or we have a sound. That sound, let's say that the first person who ever saw a saber-toothed tiger run by, the first Homo erectus, said, "Shamalama ding dong." And let's say they said it, "Shamalama ding dong." Just those different, so they would have had not just letters, because they didn't have any letters, actually. They would have had more than just consonants and vowels. They would have had pitches that they use. All languages we know of today use pitch, frequency, high, low, mid. And all of this would have entered in, plus gestures. They would have used gestures as well. All the evidence we have suggests that all languages use gestures and that they're a very fundamental part. So they would have said something. The people around them would have tried to interpret that. It might not have even had an interpretation originally. You know, so Chomsky gives this famous sentence, "Colorless green ideas sleep furiously," and he uses that sentence to show that grammar is not the same as meaning. But ironically, everybody who ever hears that sentence tries to figure out a meaning, and most people do come up with a meaning. It varies a lot, but we can find meanings. And the minute that we as a society agree that a sentence or a word means something, that's what it means. There's nothing further to say about it. And it's that way that culture contributes and provides the basis for coming up with symbols, in the invention of symbols. So symbols are sort of like the first joke. You think of any favorite joke of yours, who told it for the first time? And was it the first telling the same as the last? Probably it got modified a lot, and one person had an idea that was then developed by somebody else. We can see this on some of the experiments online, where they take just random sequences of sounds, and people simply click which sequences they prefer, and pretty soon, after a short period of time with lots of people participating, those sounds become recognizable melodies. So as people tweak each other's statements, the other thing we should that is really important to point out when I talk about conversations, there is an expression, always say what you mean and mean what you say, but in fact nobody does that. I can't even imagine a language in which that was entirely possible. We say things that generally mean in the range of things we'd like people to interpret. If I say jump, what did I mean by that? That I mean that somebody else jumped or that you should jump. So we interpret a lot of information we project onto the sentence that wasn't there. So languages, when they start, but even as they come along fully developed like English, a lot of the meaning that is provided in our conversations is based on our shared assumptions, our shared culture, our shared understanding of the values and the knowledge structures and social roles that we're engaging in that undergird this entire communicative action. So that Erectus would have, as we did, interpreted sentences partially based on the symbols in the sentences, but partially based on the general cultural knowledge about them. It's one reason that it becomes difficult to learn a second language, even if we've memorized the entire dictionary and the grammar, because we don't know exactly what the understood implicit information. So if I give examples of this in both books about how if you just read something from the newspaper, if you're not from this culture, it's going to be difficult for you to understand it because the words alone won't be sufficient. It's the same thing with erectus speech or sapien speech.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines here and let listeners call in with their comments or questions. The phone number is 707-895-2448. I do have somebody holding on the line here, Dan, so I'm going to go ahead and take that call. Hi there, sure. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please? Hello?
Mona.
Hi, Mona. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Stewart, I'm so sorry. Mr. Campbell, I'm sorry that you're leaving. I hope you reconsider. I love your show.
Well, thank you.
I was going to say that the United States of America is not the most developed country in the world. If we look at it from a language and cultural point of view, I don't know how many years we can go back and reconsider, because we have been hijacked, and there is no progress being made in the arena of language and culture. There's only one language, and one language does not represent all of the different cultures that have come, that have emigrated to the United States with different languages and cultures that are theirs and that should not be changed and cannot be changed in 5 or 10 generations, and they shouldn't. It's too easy to learn a language, but the people who make the rules say it isn't. And unless the United States changes that, which I don't see it happening, like in Europe, you know, people speak 5 languages like it's no big deal, because it is no big deal. But in this country, we have been hijacked, politicized to think that it is.
Mona, let's let Dan respond to your comments. Thanks very much.
That's an excellent point. We live in a very large monolingual culture in which the reason people don't learn other languages, I totally agree with you, is not because they're too difficult to learn, because one of our cultural values is not valuing other languages and other cultures. There's a law for that. But I agree with you that one of the greatest riches in the world today is linguistic and cultural diversity, and that our country could benefit tremendously by having more language programs. As a college dean, one of the things that saddens me is to see the weakening of language programs all across the country, so that students prefer not to take languages these days, and that's a shift in cultural values that I would very much like to see changed.
Got another call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Hi, this is Jesse.
Hi, Jesse, go ahead.
Hi, I want to offer a slight rebuttal to the last caller, and I understand that the you know, people are, they tend to be a little bit xenophobic about learning a new language. I get that there's part of that, but there are massive changes happening in the language here. The LGBTQ community, for instance, has really challenged the gender arrangement of pronouns and the kind of inherent sexism of the language, and that's changing all over the place. Also, every single time a new wave of immigrants comes in, they bring a term or a bit of slang or a way of expressing something that influences the language. And we've seen it even within our own cultures here, where, for instance, the African-American community, when they come in and they have, like, hip-hop and rap becoming popular, all kinds of terms from that culture now become mainstream culture. And that's happening all the time. And even from generation to generation, the slang is completely different. We have a couple of pieces of slang that have stayed for a long time, like cool. But, you know, it's different even from decade to decade. So, you know, there's a lot of flexibility there.
Right.
But now my question for your guest, when I was learning French, it took me forever to realize that the way they divided the gender in their language didn't have anything to do with the meaning. It didn't have anything to do with, like, the object being discussed. It had to do with the endings of the words. So, you know, if it was E-T-T-E, it would be feminine. If it was E-T, it would be masculine. And I want to know if he has any clue on how that came about, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse.
Well, let me ask two things, or basically made 2 points. So the first one is about languages changing, and you're absolutely correct that they're always changing, and that just like new foods start to creep through the culture as immigrants come over, so do new words and expressions. I think that both the previous callers are correct. One is that Americans don't learn entire new languages readily, but on the other hand, we are always changing, and we're always trying to make some adaptations in the language, and different communities have led that. With respect to gender, You know, the most extreme example that I know of are the Bantu languages of Africa, which have 54 or more different noun classes, which would be roughly genders. These things start off historically, so the one reason they're called genders in languages like French and Spanish is because they largely do correlate with gender at the in some cases, but then over time they take on a life of their own and they become quite different and separate from gender. So nobody in Brazil, for example, where we would say that Coca-Cola is feminine, a Coca-Cola, not o Coca-Cola, I don't think anybody actually associates Coca-Cola with a feminine entity. But that just is an arbitrary classification. And so we see this happen. You know, in one of the languages I work with in the Amazon, Wadi, there are three genders. There's masculine, feminine, and neuter. But feminine includes all kinds of creatures in addition to human females. Neuter includes only a much smaller class of creatures, and masculine is only human males. So that it still doesn't correspond quite to gender as we normally think about it, and that's because languages change over time, just as Jesse said they did, and these changes take initial things and make them quite different than what they started off to be.
Let's take another call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Tim.
Tim, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for keeping me on the side, Stuart, so I didn't get dropped.
You're welcome.
And I also hope you reconsider and keep a show.
Okay.
You know, your guest's affection for language is evident. I just want to mention a couple of words that he didn't use. One is ramify, how meanings at any given time, they take on several meanings, and they're all valid, but the difficulty in hearing them is in sorting them. And so the other idea I think that needs to be coupled with it is pattern recognition, because we need to always pull out the correct meaning out of the various meanings. And that's even kind of pre-verbal. So there's something healthy working out earlier that found its way into language and continues on, and actually is very challenged now through the kind of dialogue that's going on to ascertain the truth.
Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you both.
Yeah. Pattern recognition is crucial. I completely agree with that, and so is homonymy, the idea that, and polysemy, the idea that one word can have several meanings, or that several words can have the same sounds. And so there's really interesting studies coming out of the Brain and Cognitive Sciences Department at MIT that show that ambiguity is actually something you expect to find in highly efficient communicative systems, because the more separate symbols you have to learn, the more burden you place on the person trying to learn the language. So it's better to learn some that overlap and be able to sort them out by context. And this, so like, how do we know that it's T-O-O versus T-O versus T-W-O? We know based on the context. It's the same thing, and that relates back to the other point that the caller made, Tim, which is pattern recognition. And I've often characterized babies as little Googlers. They're like a little Google machine. They recognize patterns and page ranks and the equivalent of page ranks. They know what things are most likely to come next. They use strongly statistical generalization systems to come up with their understanding of the world. And a lot of research is going into this in psychology and the cognitive sciences more generally. And I do mention this in Dark Matter of the Mind and in How Language Began, and those are very good points.
Okay, well, Dan, we are down almost out of time here. I want to give you a chance to kind of sum up or say anything you want to say in closing. I found the book to be a really fascinating read, and there's just so much that we weren't able to talk about. Again, my guest has been Dan Everett. He's author of How Language Began, The Story of Humanity's Greatest Invention. So, Dan, anything you'd like to say in closing?
I think the important thing is to realize that we're part of an evolutionary chain of being, and that as a species, we owe a tremendous amount to the species that preceded us. And in particular, as humans, Homo erectus, as I've studied them now over the last couple of years, has become my hero. They were the first. They were the pioneers. They made a lot of discoveries and inventions that have made our lives possible. The first Homo sapiens, if I'm right, was born into a world in which language already existed.
Dan Everett, again, author of The How Language Began, The Story of Humanity's Greatest Invention. Thanks once again for joining us on Consider This. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Stuart.
Bye-bye.